Okay, we're back.
Like, really back.
How about that?
Not just back from, you know, a commercial break. Like, we took a hiatus there for a while.
3 weeks. It's all your fault.
It is all my fault.
You were here in the office toiling away.
I was so few feet away from the room that we're sitting in right now. And I thought about it. I was going to come in and just, you know, yell into a microphone about my feelings for a while. But it turns out it's not any fun without you.
Oh.
I would have just wept openly, and that nobody,
nice.
I'm not a pretty crier.
That's like, nice.
It doesn't, it's, I'm an ugly crier. Nobody wants to hear that.
I'm flattered.
Thank Wait, you. So you have stories. You were gone fighting sharks, as I understand.
Yeah, ninjas.
Ninjas.
Shark ninjas.
Ninja sharks.
No.
Okay.
I had family stuff to attend to. I was down in Los Gatos, California, which is like, if you're not familiar, it's, if you leave San Jose and start driving towards Santa Cruz, which is on the coast.
Okay.
The first town you pass through is Los Gatos. So it's very close to San Jose. It's like on the line to San Jose.
Waz
lives there.
Much of a claim to fame that it's on the way between San Jose and Santa Cruz.
Right.
It's not that exciting.
It's like technically a suburb of San Jose, but
okay.
It's very well to do, obviously. I mean, it's part of Silicon Valley.
Sure.
Waz lives there.
So you were hanging out with Waz for 3 weeks.
No, I'm always on the lookout for him when I'm down there, though.
I feel like he's got to be around. He seems like one of those people who's always out doing stuff.
Yeah, on his Segway.
Yeah, exactly.
So the funny part is, well, there's lots of funny parts about Los Gatos, but it's basically like, you know, a well-to-do suburb.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really much of anything there. It's like a cultural dead zone. There's some good restaurants and some nice things, but I borrowed a friend's car. She drives I think 2012 BMW 3 Series.
Ooh.
It's really, really nice. It's got a ton of awesome features. It's got like the wood paneled interior.
It's also one of those cars that you just get behind the wheel and like, I've never really owned nice cars, but every time I drive a 3 Series, I'm like, oh, I should buy a nice car.
Yeah. It's like really, really nice.
Yeah.
But the funny part is like driving around San Francisco, you know, it's different. Like I live in the Mission, and there's a lot of tension about like rich people moving in,
sure.
tech workers moving in. And even though I'm like a technology journalist, I'm not like, I guess I technically am a tech person because I work in the technology industry.
Sure.
Right? I work at a giant website. Okay. I may as well just own it, but
sure.
I don't own a car. I had to borrow this car. But when I drive her, like when I drive her car around in San Francisco and I'm borrowing her car, it's like, I get funny looks, you know, because I'm that guy.
Right.
I'm the guy in the Beamer driving around.
It does say something when you're rolling around in a 3 Series, like your window's down, listening to Fish, which I assume you're just doing all the time.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's like, there's a message there.
But when you're in Los Gatos, you get funny looks for driving that car for different reasons. Because you're only driving a 3 Series.
They're like, your car's 3 years old, man. Time to upgrade.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's the shitty one.
Oh, that's true.
You know, it's like, and there's absolutely nothing shitty about this car. But
nope.
I mean, nobody explicitly walks up to you and says, I can't believe you're driving a 3 Series BMW.
They're like, sorry, sir, you actually have to leave.
But, you know, like you get looks, and you get looks for different reasons.
Fair.
I mean, it's helpful if you know what I look like. I look like a filthy hippie. I don't necessarily look like the kind of guy who you would expect to see driving a BMW unless you lived in San Francisco, because a lot of people in San Francisco just look like filthy hippies.
Right. All of San Francisco is filthy hippies with Facebook stock.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's essentially everyone who lives here now.
I don't own any stock. Oh, actually, I'm so sure I have a 401k. But I don't know what's in it. It's better for that. But
one nice thing about being a journalist is like I have such a good excuse for not having any idea what's going on in the stock market.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I'm ethically prohibited from doing it anyway.
We were talking about this yesterday about like how little it makes sense. Like with the Microsoft news.
Oh, it's insanity.
Right?
Yeah.
Like Microsoft is, you know, obviously in a lot of trouble
mm-hmm.
as far as the mobile future of the technology industry goes. And yet, because they made these big write-offs and because they're laying people off, their P&L is going to look better at the end of the quarter.
Right.
So their stock price is like doing fine.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, like, that's the crazy thing about the stock market to me. And it's the weird thing about being a public company is that you have to be so, like, every quarter is the ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of it, you play another game.
Mm-hmm.
But like if you have you don't get to have a bad quarter. If you mm-hmm. have a bad quarter, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Which is why, and then there's like Samsung, which is you know, everybody's ragging on Samsung because the Galaxy S6 isn't selling as well as it's supposed to be. But Samsung is still making outrageous amounts of money. Mm-hmm. They're just making, you know, outrageous amounts of money minus $300. And everybody freaks out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's suddenly, and like Farhad Manjoo wrote a piece about this for the Times, I think last week, basically being like, yeah, all these companies are opting to stay private now. Because going public comes with all these pressures that don't make any sense.
Yeah, you know, you start making decisions based on keeping the shareholders happy instead of keeping your customer base happy.
Right, and like to be successful as a tech company, you have to think long enough. And long enough goes beyond a quarter. Mm-hmm. And it's why, and like, you know, Amazon is the exception, right? Where Amazon gets to do whatever it wants.
I feel like the only reason they're able to do whatever they want is because they've always been very, very upfront about we're not going to make a lot of profit.
Right.
Because I think that's what a lot of, I mean, okay, here's two guys talking about Wall Street who have no idea about any of this shit. But from what I've learned is that it's about expectations, right? Like the company says, this is what we expect to do.
Mm-hmm.
We expect to have this much growth and this much profit. And then the numbers come out at the end and they've already briefed the consultants. And if the numbers are different than or don't exceed what they've already briefed, then that's when the people say bad things about them. And like, okay, they're doomed.
Well, and Amazon is not in consumer electronics, right? Like they ran into all this trouble with the Fire Phone because the Fire Phone is a steaming pile of garbage.
And it sold about as well as a steaming pile.
Right, and they sold 11 of them. And they took this giant write-off and it hurt their stock in a real way that hasn't necessarily before, because I feel like my impression of a lot of how it goes down on Wall Street is that people have these very simplistic numbers. Mm-hmm. And when you hit the numbers, they're psyched, and when you miss them, they're angry.
Yeah.
And that propagates across all of Wall Street. And
it's all such a game.
Amazon
too.
Is so opaque that they just don't have that, right? Where they're like, Apple comes out and they're like, we sold this many phones. And they're like, that's a bigger number than last time. Hooray. Whereas Amazon doesn't, like, they have revenue numbers, but those are not as easy to imagine in your head, I feel like. And so it's, I don't know, Amazon's a weird company. I also feel like Jeff Bezos is so uniquely loved that I think Steve Jobs could have gotten away with it for a while if Apple hadn't made any money.
Yeah.
But Apple started making money so fast, and once you start making money, you can't stop making money.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Jeff Bezos is just so charismatic and has never made any money that everybody's just waiting on him because he seems so smart that he knows what he's doing.
Well, also, I mean, they can show like growth of customer base.
Yes.
And that's one, like they don't show monetary growth because they recycle all of their profits back into the business, you know, and because of that, they can show new customers and growing, and they move into new markets.
Right.
I mean, you know, you have to remember this is a company that started out shipping books.
And now they're going to take over everything.
Yeah.
Now they make drones.
So they've just been doing that for, they've just been on like a steady march towards world domination for like the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah. But then I wonder when it flips and somebody is going to be like, okay, you did it. You're in charge of everything. Now go make some money.
Mm-hmm. I honestly don't think they're going to be like extremely wildly profitable or able to dominate fully until they own the full stack, and for them that's shipping.
Yeah, I agree.
Like there was sort of that, I don't know if it was a meme or a joke about a year ago where like, oh, Amazon's going to buy UPS, you know?
I mean, it can happen. Like it's not that crazy an idea. That's the thing about Amazon. It's like anything about Amazon seems plausible.
Mm-hmm.
It's like anything
Google's like that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's talk about Microsoft.
Okay. Oh, before we talk about Microsoft, I want to tell that story.
Oh, yeah. Go.
About while I was out. It was thinking about me being a dirty hippie made me think of this. I watch a lot of Grateful Dead concerts.
Nice.
And I watch them from the comfort of my own home on the Roku, which was just amazing to me.
Okay. I have a lot of questions.
Okay.
So was it – it's really my first question. Like is that – is it actually – what percentage of the quality of experience would you say it is watching it on your TV on a Roku versus being there live?
It's the next best thing.
Okay.
It's the next best
thing. Fair enough.
So the neat thing about it is that like I've been doing – it's this sort of subculture. It's called couch tour, right? So like hashtag couch tour.
Nice.
Basically when a band is playing and it's a band that has like a big fan base, like we do this with Phish a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They broadcast their shows either on the website it's usually on the website. It's usually some sort of web-based streaming, right? So you have to take your computer and hook your computer up to your television.
Right.
And then go on the browser and update your Flash player.
Which is always terrible.
Yeah.
That experience always sucks.
Yeah. I mean, it works. But sure. It takes, like, there's always that sort of, like, you know, nervous feeling that it's mm-hmm. not going to work and that it's going to take a little bit of extra time. You know, you see it, like, you know, it's starting at 5 p.m. So you start right. setting up for it at like 4.
Yep.
Because you don't know how long it's going to take.
Right.
But yeah, it usually takes about 15, 20 minutes to get one of those working. And then once it's working, you're dealing with Flash player issues. So it could crash. There's audio visual sync problems. You know, you're paying $20 for it.
Yeah.
So it's like none of this is really acceptable to you right. because you're paying such a high dollar amount.
Right.
For
it's not like you're doing like the illegal Russian stream of a soccer game, which is what I do all the time. And it's right. it's a terrible experience. And I'm like, okay, well, this is what it is.
Right. You get just enough information so you feel like you've experienced it.
Right.
But
exactly.
it's not pleasurable.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I've been doing this for at least the last 4 or 5 years. I've been watching concerts, but always through the browser. Mm-hmm. This time when the Grateful Dead came back and, you know, obviously Jerry Garcia is not with them, but 50 years of the band.
He is in spirit, by the way.
He is in spirit, yes.
He's there.
He's looking down at you from the rainbow.
Exactly.
It started as just 3 shows in Chicago, and then they added 2 more shows in Santa Clara, California, which is down there by Los Gatos.
Mm-hmm.
And this was all like June 27, June 28, and then 4th of July weekend. So it was nice. Separated by a week. So we decided we were going to watch all 5 of them because we didn't have tickets to any of the shows, and we weren't going to fly to Chicago. So
is your wife into it as much as you are, or is this something she lovingly does for you?
No, she's a huge Deadhead.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
I'm not the Deadhead in the
relationship. Oh, interesting. Okay.
She started seeing the Dead when she was like 16.
Nice.
And then Jerry died when she was 20.
Okay.
So there were a few years there where she like lived in a van.
Yeah, that's awesome. Nice. Okay.
I'm a big Fish fan, and the guitar player from Fish played the guitar parts during the shows.
Got it. Okay.
So Trey Anastasio was the right. lead guitarist and sometimes singer.
That's pretty cool.
It was really neat. The music was great.
Yeah.
But we won't bore everyone with it. anyway, the band teamed up with or the promoters rather teamed up with MLB to do the stream for the first 2 nights.
Mm-hmm.
So if you logged into MLB, you could buy it and stream it. So I was able to do that and not do it over the computer. Which was a first for me, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
And it didn't drop out, no problems. It was great. You could also do it over YouTube. So for Chicago, I like logged into, I just like, you know, went to youtube.com on my computer and saw the video, and you click buy now, and it buys it through Google Wallet or Google whatever it's called now.
I think it's Google Play now.
Yeah, so you buy it through like the Google Play Store,
yeah.
and then all of a sudden the video stream loads, and that's it, you're in YouTube. So I went on the Roku, and I went into the YouTube app and went into live, and there it was. It was like the premiere event, and I clicked on it, and it worked. I think we got like 1 dropout during each show.
That's pretty good. And were they were clearly like rigged to do this, so they had cameras in good places and the sound was good. And
yeah, so okay. this was a major streaming event.
Yeah.
So you could buy it through your Comcast DVR.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy it through YouTube. You could buy it on the website. You could buy it through MLB. Or you could go to like a listening or a viewing party, like clubs around the world had like, you know, they busted out their huge sound system and
nice.
And had a video projection. There was a place here in San Francisco that did it. There were places in Vermont that friends of mine went to.
That's cool.
Seattle, Toronto. So they're everywhere. And then also you could go to select movie theaters and watch it in a movie theater. I was on Twitter the whole time, and like the Comcast service was dropping out constantly.
Oh, wow.
People who bought it over Comcast had problems. People who bought it over Dish Network had problems. People who were viewing it on the web had sync problems. We didn't have any problems. It was like the first time this has worked.
Yeah.
So I got really philosophical about it afterwards. And I'm like, look at this. You know, you can plug into anything on YouTube and just watch it live.
Hmm.
And they've done this before with things like Bonnaroo or Coachella, where, you know, you can watch on YouTube. But this was like this for me, you know, watching it. It's like 5 hours of streaming video every night for 5 nights. And it just went off without a hitch.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think it was a good experience.
So I actually, I talked to folks at YouTube about live streaming earlier this spring, I guess. And the sleeping giant of YouTube is that they have by far the best streaming setup of anybody.
For live events.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so native to YouTube. Their buying setup is really easy, so charging for it is not a problem. They have great players that work everywhere. Like, YouTube could basically just flick this on in a big, real way and just win. Mm-hmm. It's so much better. Like, even the Hangouts on Air stuff is better than any other, like, live kind of video broadcast that people try to do now. And I just don't get why YouTube doesn't do more of this. There's so much opportunity. Like, Yahoo won this big deal to stream a football game. Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, I wish that were on YouTube instead. Because it would be way better. And they can handle the bandwidth. Like, it just seems like such an obvious victory that YouTube is leaving on the table to do more stuff like this. Because it seems like, and maybe I'm wrong, I actually think the infrastructure for all of this is probably a fascinating story.
I think so. I don't think people realize, you know, what, like, exactly how much firepower goes into something like that.
Right. And especially, like, do you remember what the numbers were? They usually have, like, the ticking number next to the streams.
No, because when you launch it in Roku, it just takes a little screen.
Right. You just see the video.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, what you want anyway.
Yeah. That's interesting, though. I wonder what the numbers were.
I bet they were big. It's interesting that the Grateful Dead is like the most tech forward version of this kind of thing.
I mean, it's not surprising, but it is interesting because it's one of those, like, turns out mm-hmm. it's one of those where, like, common knowledge wouldn't necessarily dictate that, like, a bunch of guys from the 60s have been
exactly.
are so technically on it. But the promoter is a guy who is a little bit younger, Shapiro. He ran a club in New York City in the 90s. It was like a big, like, jam band club. And now he runs the theater in things like Portchester, New York. It's some big theater on Long Island that has, like, you know, has always hosted, like, The Dead and, and Neil Young and those bands.
Yeah.
Capitol Theater. That's what it's called. Okay. The Capitol Theater. So he's, you know, he's very much on the cutting edge. And I'm sure that a lot of the people in that organization in that part of the world are on the cutting edge of doing this.
Yeah. Like, I think it's going to start happening a lot more is my guess. Like, I've always wondered about I forget the name of the company, but it's the company that takes, like, the Metropolitan Opera and shows it in movie theaters, or will take plays and show them in theaters. And it's always, like, they did a Justin Bieber concert once that was apparently gigantically popular, where it was basically, like, overflow rooms for the concert in movie theaters around the country.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing is, like, especially in the world where live programming becomes more and more precious, that stuff is going to be huge.
It's really interesting to me because, like, you know, it's interesting that it took off with things like you were saying, classical things like opera.
And it was like the ballet every year, I remember. You could see the Nutcracker in a movie theater.
And jam band music.
Yeah.
You know, those have been the things that have been at least the most visible forefront of all of this, you know, pushing towards.
Why, like, jam band music? I get classical.
I think it's because, like, the whole aesthetic of the band is that, you know, you have to be there. Like, you have to see the live show. So, so much of their, like, their artistic statement is wrapped up in the live experience, you know? It's not like you can just buy a record and listen to it. So, as it's happening, you know, all the improvisation happening on stage, people really want to experience that. And if they're playing all the way across the country and you can't afford to go, this is literally the next best thing to being there. I mean, it's happening live. You could participate on Twitter. You know, you feel like it all happens in real time. Like, you can't fast forward through the set break. Mm-hmm. You have to go do something for an hour or, like, hang out for an hour while the band is backstage, like, eating their dinner or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like, it feels a lot more inclusive. Mm-hmm. You get that same sort of, like, excitement and feeling like you would if you were at a show, which, if you're into that kind of music, that's the ultimate high, is being at the show.
Right, because, like, nobody listens to, or the point is not the recorded music.
Right, the point is the live performance.
The experience.
So listening to a recording, like, a day later of the live show is still, like, awesome.
Yeah.
And they make that, they also, those bands are the ones who've, you know, made that easier than anybody else.
Right.
But, like, actually participating in the live show is like the thing that if you're a fan of that music, you really crave. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's funny that, like, you know, things that you normally wouldn't consider to be events where the audience would be accepting of that, which is like, you know, a live opera, right? It's like, well, how good is an opera on TV? You really kind of want to be there because of the spectacle and the size of it and, the, you know, everything going on. It doesn't really translate well to television, you know? And it's like the same thing with like a Dead show or like a Phish concert or like Widespread Panic or something like that, right? You really have to be there to feel it, man. These are the two things that have like, you know, streaming has just taken off in these communities, you know? And like, I remember the Allman Brothers when they were still playing, they launched their own, you know, streaming service. Phish does livefish.com. You can, you know, buy live streams during their tours, you know, these Dead shows. It's just, it's like, I really feel like no band is really taking this. The only people who are really jumping on it are, like you said, like the people who set up those Bieber shows,
right?
Or the people, you know, who do the big festivals like Coachella and Bonnaroo, things like that, where like it's more of like a packaged experience. Like you bring in a company to run it for you,
sure.
Or the company approaches you to do it instead of the band like actually proactively saying, no, this is something we want to do,
right?
So we can reach all of our fans. I don't know.
It's pretty cool. I mean, it's I don't think I've ever streamed a concert before, which is why I ask how the experience is. But I remember like the Talking Heads Stop Making Sense DVD was like, that's an old concert, but they, you know, they shot it well and it sounds good and it looks good. And I have watched that thing so many times.
That's the second greatest concert film ever made.
It is. Mm-hmm. What's number one?
Oh, The Last Waltz.
I've never seen it.
Oh man.
I gotta watch that.
That's a good one.
Okay. I'm gonna write this down right now.
That's a good one. Scorsese.
The Last Waltz.
Everybody's in it.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Just every band on earth.
The best part is Van Morrison because he shows up in a purple jumpsuit and sings Caravan. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Radio. It's awesome. You'll love it. Okay. Should we talk about Microsoft?
Done. Yeah. Let's talk about Microsoft.
Before we go too far in the weeds, I think it's too late for that.
Oh, that's... when have we ever not done that? So, okay. So the basics of what happened with Microsoft, right? They... bought Nokia a year ago, a little over a year ago, for $7 billion, 7.2, something like that. Low sevens.
Funny money.
Funny money. And then this week, basically, I mean, more or less admitted that that was a gigantic failure of an idea, right?
Yeah.
Like that was what I got from that memo. So he wrote, they're doing this big restructuring. They laid off 18,000 people last year, I think was the number, and then 7,800 more this week or starting this week. They wrote off $7 billion. They are essentially getting rid of the whole idea of a standalone Microsoft phone business, except for quote unquote flagship phones, whatever that means.
Well, he said that they were still interested in serving their three primary customer bases with first-party products.
Right.
And last week, they announced the creation of a Surface hardware and software team.
Right. Was that last week?
I think so.
Maybe it was last month. Couple of things. I think
well,
it was
last week
month.
Was last month.
Either way, close enough.
Recently.
Yeah. So your grand theory is that there's a Surface phone coming.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it makes perfect sense. Like, first of all, you know, they say that, okay, we have this new hardware division that's just going to concentrate on Surface,
right?
And we are getting rid of our standalone third-party or, you know, standalone phone business.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think there's going to be a Surface phone. It's something that, you know, I mean, we all know that if you want to rule your little corner of the world, you have to own the whole stack.
Yep.
That's why they bought Nokia.
So I agree with everything except the last part there.
What?
I think they bought Nokia out of panic because there are all these rumors that came out that Nokia was thinking very seriously about starting to make Android phones.
Yes, which they aren't.
Right. Well, and Nokia with like the success that it had making good hardware that ran terrible Windows software, if they had swung the pendulum even slightly towards Android, they would have figured out that that's what people want, and they would have started making that, and then that would have been the end of it. And then at that point, Microsoft or Windows Phone would have just completely died on the vine.
Yeah.
So they like, and I guess they had to do this. I don't know if they should have, but on some level, I think it probably felt necessary that they were like, we have to go preserve this relationship, even if it costs us $7 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably should have just let Nokia start making Android phones.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, it seems like they are right now where they would have been a year ago if Nokia had started making Android phones, except it cost them $7 billion in the process.
And Elop's out.
Right.
You got one of the smartest minds in mobile.
Yeah, I wonder what he's going to do next.
I don't know. Probably go sell yachts.
Yes.
Or just buy one.
Yeah, just hang out.
But I do think there's going to be a Surface phone.
So, okay, to what end, though? That's like why? What is a Surface phone going to do that's interesting and compelling that will make people want to buy it?
It's going to be, okay, well, just as the Surface was Microsoft's idea of the future of the laptop, I think the Surface phone will be exemplary of Microsoft's idea, not exemplary is not the right word. It's an example of what Microsoft thinks the future of mobile phones is going to look like.
What do you think that is?
What it wants to look like. I don't know. I mean, I can see it in my head. You know, it's going to look like the Surface tablet, but phone shaped and phone sized.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
it won't have a Snap-on keyboard.
Oh, man. That'd be awesome, though.
It probably won't have a little kickstand.
Just like a teeny tiny little
tiny Surface.
That'd be adorable.
You know, it's just, full Intel chipset, all the same firepower, all the same capability mm-hmm. that you would expect from a top-tier device. And, you know, a lot like... well, actually, you know what? You should talk about your theory about what place it would play in Microsoft's developer community, like the Nexus thing.
Yeah, okay, so basically my theory is that, and really they said this, like if you read between the lines of Satya Nadella's email yesterday, he more or less said we're gonna make a phone mm-hmm. for developers mm-hmm. so that they can make a really great experience on Windows Phone, which is great, right? But if I'm a developer, and it's like Google's Nexus program where they've gone out of their way to be like, here is the sort of extreme Android experience, right? Whether it's the Nexus 6, they're like, here's what it's like to program for a big phone. It's the newest software and it has great hardware and it has, you know, the newest specs and weirdest interface ideas and all this stuff. And they're like, well, here's the bleeding edge, go build stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is great. And it's a smart thing for Microsoft to do, to build sort of the default phone, right? Because you have this gigantic community of Android users who are all using different phones, and having something that acts as a reference is really smart.
Yeah.
The problem is there is nothing that a Surface phone will be a reference for. There are no other Windows phones. Like I'm not even exaggerating. Like there are a couple of really cheap Lumias out in the world, but there are no useful, still relevant flagship Windows phones. There just aren't. There hasn't been one in a long time.
Yeah, but like the 900 Lumia series, right?
Yeah, and there were a few fine ones there. They all had great cameras, and there was nothing particularly interesting about the rest of them. But like if I'm a developer, even if I develop for Windows, why would I care about the phone at this point?
I think it's still a channel that they need to leave open.
I agree, right? And I think that's the problem, right? So I think that's the...
Like they can't just say, okay, no more mobile for Windows.
No, because it kills the whole idea.
Yeah.
If our phones are going to continue to be the centerpiece of our computing experience, and I don't think anyone smart would argue that they're not, at least not in the next 5 years. Like what's the – I forget who it was. I think it was Fred Wilson, the venture capitalist, wrote a really interesting piece where he was like, the first story has been your phone connecting you to the internet, and the next story is going to be your phone connecting you to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really smart and is like it's a thing a lot of people have talked about, and he called it the personal cloud, and he's been beating that drum for a while where it's like your phone's job is now to connect you to your watch and your shoes and your light bulb and your car and all these other things. And so then you could sort of reason out, and I think this is what Microsoft hopes happens, is that, well, why is your phone necessary? Why don't you just like have a chip in your body, or why isn't your watch the hub of those things?
Mm-hmm.
And that's all probably true, but that's a long way out, and that's not going to happen in 5 years. And what Microsoft needs is to make a case for building something that works with all of my devices. And what they just very straightforwardly admitted is that you are not going to have a Windows phone.
Yeah.
And if I don't have a Windows phone, the hell do I care if my apps work on everybody else's devices?
I mean, if I think I would care if everything that I do in my office depends on, you know, say like Office.
Sure.
Right? I want those things to be accessible on my phone.
Well, which is why it's very much to Microsoft's credit that they've built Office onto these other platforms. Uh-huh. And that's wonderful and you know, good on them for making that move.
But did you notice how quickly Office on iOS got really good?
It's really good.
It was like, it
like
was
I use Word
terrible for a long time, and then all of a sudden it got really good.
Like
really
I use
fast.
Word on purpose now on my phone. I never did that before. It's really good, and OneNote is really good, and Outlook is really good, and like they've done a really, really nice job, which is to their credit, and they didn't have to do that.
Mm-hmm. And when they switch over to Office 365, we were just talking about this today, like, you know, setting up all the services on your phone through other clients, like, for example, mail on an Exchange account. So much easier.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Used to be a disaster. Although that's also partly, you know, our company's problem.
So, you know, they're a very, very big company.
Yes.
And they have obviously been moving towards this for a while.
Sure.
You know?
But I just think, like, they're going to have to change the way they talk about Windows 10.
Yeah.
And there are lots of really good things about Windows 10. And there are lots of things worth talking about Windows 10, which is that, like, you know, it's the best way to bundle all of your Microsoft services. And that's probably true. Like, Cortana is terrific and is beautifully executed in Windows 10. And the browser looks nice. And it's a better way to get all of your Office apps and all this stuff. But that's it. There is no case for the one operating system across all your devices anymore, because it's at best the operating system that runs across all your devices minus the most important one.
Well,
and at that point, who cares?
I mean, that's a good question, because does it still make sense for me to have like a Surface and a desktop PC at work and an Xbox at home and have apps that work across those devices, even if my phone is out of the equation?
But absolutely. I mean, that's the Mac case, right? Where the more devices you buy, the better off you are, even if the other things do technically plug into that same ecosystem. But you're not going to switch because of it.
I can't get excited about something that's not going to work with my phone.
No, except in like hacky, weird ways. Like, And at this point, honestly,
if I have to read a web page to figure out how it works,
pass.
Yeah.
But at this point, all the best things about Windows, which are all those services, are already great on other platforms. So fine. Like, I'm actually not worse off for having a Windows PC and an Android phone, which is, I think, probably the reason they made the decision that they did, because they're like, well, you can still have a good Windows experience. But then they can't talk about Windows the way that they have. Like, Windows 10 was this grand sweeping play across everything, and now it isn't. Now it's a really good desktop operating system that will work well with all the services you use on your other devices. And that's fine, and that works, and that's a pretty good case to make. It's a whole hell of a lot better than any Windows I've ever used before. And that's good enough. But that's it. And then that's not going to win the Internet of Things. It's not going to win VR. Like, none of they're not starting a ball rolling here. They're just building a better desktop Windows.
Well, you know, I think that they're probably going to continue making Windows Phone hardware in some respect. Do you think?
Yeah, but 70 people will use it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I figure, you know, they may be thinking that if they make it, that will be a good way to demonstrate the power of having Windows Phone hardware.
Right.
But is that demonstration enough to convince people to switch to a Windows Phone? No.
Right.
It's not.
Well,
I
mean,
they're kind of like, even if they're going to pursue it, I don't think it's anything that they're going to be able to get people excited about.
Right. You know? I think the value, like, I agree with you that they're going to make a Surface phone, and I think they're going to make a Surface phone so that they can get up on stage and say, look how well all these things work together.
Mm-hmm.
And then when somebody asks, well, how much market share does Windows Phone have? Satya Nadella is going to like plug his ears and start singing.
Yeah. 3%.
Right. And that's how they're going to have to be.
Yeah.
Because like, not only do they not make phones, really, not only is their software not very good, but they don't care. Like, that was the other thing that I got out of that letter, is they're like, yeah, fine, phone's dead. It's not going to work.
How do you feel as a Windows Phone developer right now?
Oh, I get out.
Yeah.
Why would I, like, what's the upside? The
upside. It was a trick question. There are no Windows
Phone developers. Well, there's also that. Well, no, there's the one guy who makes copies of apps like Instagram that are way better than Instagram.
Yeah.
I love that guy.
Yeah. That one guy.
And he just makes a ton of money doing it.
And he eats ramen noodles.
Yeah, exactly. but like, yeah, I just, I get why Microsoft is doing this, and I get why it's going to make their next quarter look better. And I get why, I get the bet that they're making, and I think it's the wrong bet.
Yeah. It is kind of sad.
Yeah. And I think what happened is Microsoft lost a bigger battle than it thinks it lost, because they were never going to win in phones, right? So you might as well cut your losses and get out and stop spending money. They were just flushing money down the toilet trying to continue to win in phones.
So when you say the bet, like, what is the bet?
Well, I think their fundamental bet is that the smartphone is going to not be your most important device soon. Mm-hmm. That it'll be your watch or the chip in your head or...
Your Xbox
or your... or whatever.
Your HoloLens.
Yeah, like, I really think they're betting that the smartphone... as your primary connection to everything is going to die. And because if it does, Microsoft's in a great spot. Mm-hmm. They're doing good work on the Internet of Things. They're doing good work on virtual reality. They're doing good work on desktop. They're doing good work on all kinds of different things. But if the phone continues to be the thing, and if most people use phones the way they currently use phones, which is mostly the way that they come out of the box, then they're not going to win the Internet of Things, because HomeKit is just as easy and you don't have to do any extra work.
Yeah.
Or they're not going to win in VR, because your phone is going to power, your Android phone is going to power whatever VR thing you use. Mm-hmm. And if your phone is the driver for all this stuff, there's no Microsoft there. That's actually not true. There's no Windows there. There's plenty of Office there, and there's lots of upside for Microsoft in getting in on that stuff. And if HoloLens is a broader experience than Microsoft is currently let on, that might work too. And they have the Azure stuff that's running web apps, and that might work. So there are lots of places Microsoft can play, but Windows gets shut out really hard there.
Yeah.
And then if your phone is your first interaction with technology, which for lots of people it's going to be, there's a lot less reason to buy a Windows computer when you have... an Android phone or an iPhone. Like, if most people's first experience with the internet is an iPhone, those people, I would bet, become dramatically more likely to buy a Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And on Android, you're going to buy a whatever. You're going to buy a Chromebook, or you're going to buy a Mac, or you have a whole wealth of options that are not available to you if you use a Windows phone.
Right.
Which is great. So there's no lock-in for Windows anymore, which is great for consumers and terrible for Microsoft.
Yeah. It's kind of sad.
It is a little sad.
I mean, I always was rooting for Windows Phone, you know?
I was too.
The hardware is nice. Like, come on, pick it up.
I think Windows Phone had a lot of really good ideas. Mm-hmm. A lot of them.
I like all the mobile platforms.
Yeah.
Well, except for BlackBerry. I don't know.
Well, BlackBerry is not a mobile platform.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a pretend joke that they sell Toys R Us.
It's not a modern mobile platform. But, I was always kind of rooting for it to take off. I like that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I like the way Microsoft thinks about the world. Like, I think the vision they pitched for Windows 10, like, if I could, I'm so locked into so many things at this point that switching costs are really high. But mm-hmm. if I could basically shut it all down and start over, I would probably pick Windows.
I would not.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I would pick the vision of Windows. Like, if Windows 10 is as good as it's supposed to be and actually delivers on the promises, mm-hmm. There's a lot that's really compelling there. And they've built better, like, iCloud is awful, and as Apple becomes more reliant on iCloud, Apple becomes worse, and Android is totally mobile, so for a lot of the work that I do, it doesn't work quite the same way.
How many prompts per day would you say you get to sign into iCloud?
Oh my God, a thousand.
Yeah.
And you
just miss it every single time?
Yeah.
And why isn't there a little box that says, never show me this again?
Yeah, that says, please, for the love of God. Like, I pay Apple, I think, like, $10 a month for iCloud storage that I have no idea what it's for. But I would pay double that easily
to just never have to think about it.
Worry about iCloud. Like, if there was a button that was like, sync with something else, it'll cost you $1,000, I probably would have done it by now.
Speaking of iCloud, the beta of iOS 9 is – the public beta of iOS 9 is coming out today.
It's – yeah.
And
by the time anybody listens to it, it'll be out.
Yeah. And the most people have already upgraded their, what, it was like 8.4 that brought you music. But you know, when you buy a new device, now it'll come with music on it. So people are starting to experience Apple Music. Have you been playing with Apple Music?
I have been playing with Apple Music. I would say, so I pay for Apple Music, Spotify, and Audio. Audio because I always forget to cancel it. I should probably do that today, actually. But but I would say at this point, I'm probably 70% Apple Music, 30% Spotify.
Really?
Mostly just out of curiosity.
Yeah.
And also, I listen to Beats 1 a lot more than I expected to.
Really?
Especially because I have such an aggressive love-hate relationship with Beats 1 and Zane Lowe in particular. What do you think? You've been using it too. What do you think?
I have been. I love the idea of Beats 1. I love the idea of, you know, live radio being a big part of this. I can't listen to it for any more than like 10 minutes.
Why not?
It's just, just don't like the music.
Oh, okay.
I don't like the music. I always just want to listen to something else. I'm just like, this isn't doing it for me. I want to listen to something else. Maybe it's just because I have better taste than everybody else in the world, which is what I'm just assuming is
well, obviously,
on.
Yeah.
So I have been doing the thing that I usually do whenever I test out a new music streaming service, which I just start searching for the most obscure stuff that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Apple Music has all of it.
It does.
So I've always said it's not about like who has all the songs because nobody has everything.
Right.
You know, but
wait, so what are your like go-to weird songs that you search for?
Oh God. Well, I search for, like Peter Brotzman records.
Okay.
Terry Riley records.
I don't know any of these people.
I search for early 80s UK punk.
Ooh. Okay.
You know, I search for a lot of like Southern California punk stuff. I search for a lot of the Rad Jew series out of New York, Zadok Records,
nice.
John Zorn.
Sure.
Records that those guys have done in Europe, like Mark Rebo and Nels Klein, you know, have done a lot of weird like trio records. I search for all that stuff.
So and Apple Music does better there than anybody else?
Anybody else.
Really?
Yeah, like none of the Zadok stuff is on RDO.
Okay.
I also search for a lot of weird, I'm really into like psych rock. So there's a lot of bands out of Europe that you know, are just impossible to find. Bands like Hills, the early stuff by Dunyan. It's more likely that you'll find that stuff because there's so many distribution deals there.
Right.
But with the smaller jazz stuff in particular and like the noise stuff and some of the like older obscure UK stuff that I like, there aren't the distribution deals with the US houses. So it's harder to find on Apple
Right.
Music. Yeah. Anyway.
So and was all that stuff on iTunes before?
Because
I feel like that's the big advantage that Apple has with a lot of this stuff is they can like they have all these existing relationships because if you wanted to sell your music, you had to be on iTunes.
I'm assuming that because it's on Apple Music, it was on iTunes.
Yeah.
But I so rarely bought music from iTunes.
Yeah, that's fair.
That I can't really say. But so that's the first thing I did is I just, you know, just search the catalog a little bit, see what kind of surprises are there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, pleasantly surprised. And then I started looking around like For You, you know, I did a little thing where you tap the bubbles.
Nice.
And For You. And it showed me some playlists. There was one that was like classic rock.
Sure.
And I clicked on that and I scrolled through it and I saw like out of maybe 30 songs, I saw two songs that I had no interest in.
Mm.
So that's great.
Yeah, that's really good.
I was like, okay, this is cool. You know, and I put it on. I think the first tune was like Rolling Stones, Angie.
Nice.
You know, and then the next song was like, I think like Tiny Dancer, Elton John.
Mm.
And I'm like, okay, this is like, you know, very like the primo cut off of every album.
Yeah.
No deep cuts at all.
Right. Which is kind of Apple Music's move, I've seen. Like they do a lot of sort of skimming the surface of stuff, which is fine because normally it's like I want to hear 50 consecutive songs that I know and like.
Yep.
Apple Music does that really well.
It did do some good things for me for discovery also.
Mm.
Like I dug into singer-songwriter, I dug into modern jazz, I dug into modern reggae, which was like, okay, put on your seatbelts. Let's see what the reggae playlist is like. And, you know, it was not bad.
Okay.
It wasn't bad. It was pretty good. I think when I identified the types of reggae that I liked, I identified enough. There's sort of like this split in reggae music, right? There's like what they call conscious reggae, mm-hmm. which is all about Ja and it's all about love. And then there's like, you know, the sort of hardcore stuff that is a lot about like, you know, my gun, my sexual organs, your sexual organs, how much money I'm making. And it really kind of fell into the more conscious stuff because that's what I enjoy. Mm-hmm. So I was like, bravo.
Yeah.
Awesome. Playlists are great. Love it. Singer-songwriter stuff, you know, a lot of it was kind of schmaltzy, kind of, you know, not really rootsy, really slick, wasn't really super into it. But I did hear some stuff that I liked that I never would have encountered had I not clicked on that
button. Okay.
Okay. The bad stuff. The interface. Can't stand it.
Oh, it's awful.
So confused.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like they went at it. it's obvious that they've got this all this legacy iTunes stuff. And then they're trying to build a music discovery and an a la carte service mm-hmm. system and curated playlists and a radio station on top of all of that. It's such a mess.
Well, which would have been great, right? Like that's the ideal. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting move for iTunes mm-hmm. and for Apple to like build all of those things together and actually like make them flow from one to another, where you can like be listening to Beats 1 and you're like, oh, I like that song. What other songs are like this? And then it leads you to that. And then it's like, oh, well, you like this song. Here's some other songs we think you might like. And then it's like, oh, great. Well, I save those to my library. Oh, you want to buy them and download them? Like, oh, great. And like,
yeah,
it's a beautiful, virtuous circle, except they just screwed it up everywhere.
Yeah. It's really hard to figure out where you are.
Yeah.
And you can't really go... You can only go back. Mm-hmm. You can't really go up the hierarchy from where. So if you find yourself somewhere new, you kind of have like to figure out, oh, this looks like a really cool section over here. You can't just explore that. Or maybe you can. I don't know. I could not figure it out.
No, you can't really.
Back all the way to the top of the file tree where I was browsing.
Yep.
And like, you know, looking at it like a file system. I had to go back all the way up to the root and find that section and then go into it from a different angle. You know, it's difficult to navigate. Also... have you gotten iTunes 12.2?
Yes.
The update that has music built into it? I mean, they caused enough confusion and strife when they upgraded to iTunes 11, like 4 years ago now, mm-hmm. 3 years ago. And now it's like I got to relearn it all over again.
Yeah.
And I feel like I can kind of get there because I dug so hard into the mobile experience.
Yeah. And it is... reasonably well replicated on the desktop, which is not necessarily to say it's a good thing because those experiences shouldn't be the same. But
because now there's like a For You button on the desktop, and it's like I'm just clicking around iTunes. I just want to find that song that has been on my hard drive forever. And
right
now, all of a sudden, I'm in Apple Music and I'm streaming stuff from the internet. Like, argh!
Yeah, it's bad. It really is. And like the hierarchy thing is interesting because that I think that is like. For me, at least, the fundamental problem. I never know where I am, and I never know how to get back to somewhere without search. And mm-hmm. I don't want to just spend my whole life searching for stuff.
So I'm choosing to look at it as not a problem. I'm choosing to look at it as a feature rather than a bug.
Why? How is it a feature?
I'm just going to fall down this hole.
Interesting.
And see where I land.
Okay.
You know, and all of a sudden, here I'm at a playlist. What is this?
I don't know how I got here, but here we are.
Yeah. You know, okay, that was fun. Let's go back to the beginning. It's like a choose your own adventure.
Fair enough.
You know, it's like...
I like that.
Look at it this way. If you're opening it up and you want to start navigating around, mm-hmm. chances are you're of the mindset of give me something to listen to.
Yes,
so fair. It serves that, you know? Even if you don't have total control over where you are, you're not really exactly sure where you are.
It will give you something to listen to.
Right, and you'll still probably have an enjoyable experience. Yeah. If you concentrate on, where am I? How come I'm lost? Where did all my stuff go? Then you're just going to get frustrated. Mm-hmm. So you just got to kind of let that go.
Yeah, that's fair. My guess would be that it's people will like it or hate it in direct correlation to how carefully they curated their iTunes libraries.
Yes.
And I would guess that you are a person who very carefully curated your iTunes library.
Meticulous.
Yeah. See, I didn't. Mine was just a giant mess of things. And mm-hmm. And I never really paid attention to my library anyway, which is funny because it's the exact opposite of Spotify, where I very carefully curate a library. Mm-hmm. But in iTunes or in Apple Music and in iTunes, it feels a little more chaotic. And at least with like the library, I'm a little more okay with the chaos. Mm-hmm. Because like right now I'm looking at it and it is the most confusing mix of music I bought and music I added to my library and music that I'm not 100% sure how it got here and like a voice recording I added one time.
Yeah.
And all of it is just bananas. And I'm mostly okay with that. Mostly. Sometimes it's annoying. But the
I'm sweating right now. And I'm having a hard time listening to you say that. My God, man.
Yeah.
Get your house in order.
It's the playlists tab that I can't handle. Because yeah. I do like playlists, and I like I stole this from somebody I worked with when
Okay, do you mean playlists within Apple Music or the playlist panel that shows up on the left side of the iTunes UI?
Exactly.
Like which one?
No, I don't know, and this is my exact problem, right? So I both enjoy listening to playlists that other people make, and I enjoy curating playlists.
Okay.
So I have one where I stole this from somebody I worked with at The Verge, where he would make a playlist of. Like the first day of every month, he would make a playlist and it was just that month and like liked. Mm. And it would be every new song that I discovered that month, I would just dump into a playlist.
I see.
And so then it becomes a great repository if I can go back and be like, I was listening to this one song constantly last Christmas. And then I can go back and like listen to the playlist.
Yeah.
And it brings back like memories of that month and it's cool. Yeah.
Never going to give you up.
Exactly. It's always
by Rick Astley.
The first song in every playlist is just never going to give you up. But I don't know how to make those playlists in any kind of useful way in Apple Music. I don't really know where they go.
That's a good point.
I'm looking at them right now and it's like I have a million weird smart playlists and then the 1 month playlist that I've only actually managed to add 2 songs to. And one of these I've never heard before. I don't get it. Like Apple, they really want you to have the exact experience that they want you to have.
Yeah. That's always been a problem with me for music apps. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're like our playlists are the shit. You should listen to our playlists. Shut up.
No.
And I'm like, I that's great. I will
Everybody
do that.
Knows you never mess with the white man's radio. I mean, like this is the same problem I have with Spotify. Mm-hmm. You know, I like the idea of a streaming service and I think that they're great and they have a good selection and they have good price point, great, you know, awesome, gigantic community. But, when you do searches, you know, you get a mishmash of things that are on your hard drive and things that are, it's like those should not be under the same roof.
Right.
The way, and Apple Music does the same thing and that drives me a little bit nuts.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I like total control. I mean, I know I'm in the minority.
Sure. But they should give that to you, right? Like it should be, and especially Apple had the opportunity to do that, to make it so that you could be as meticulously curated and controlled as you wanted to be, because they've always done that with iTunes and all its imperfections, they've done it.
That's the thing. Like iTunes, every new version of iTunes that comes out, when I open it up, I see a view that I don't like.
Mm.
I see, you know, here's some cool stuff that you added recently and here's some stuff that we added recently in our store.
I'm like, just give me my library.
And I'm like, look, I want a complete, you know, super information dense list that I can sort based on date added or artist or album. And I want nothing else. So whenever I open up a new version of iTunes, it's like I spend 30 seconds figuring out exactly how to get there and then how to customize that.
Yeah.
In like different ways. And I, you know, okay, what's different now? How do I do this? How do I set this as the default view? You know, just so like I know that when I open iTunes, I get something that I expect.
Right.
And if I click on something and that goes away, I know how to get it back.
You know how to get back. Right. You know who does that weirdly well is Google Play Music.
Yeah.
It's the only one that I've seen that does a good job of actually bifurcating those two things.
Yeah. And I still don't like the fact that when you log into Google Play Music, you get like, you know, like.
Well, yeah. There are 1,000 things that are awful about Google Play Music, but that one is good.
Yeah.
They just need designers who are better at their jobs.
I have zero complaints about it.
I think about Google Play Music?
Yeah. Granted, I mean, I really only use it for, I've talked about this before, but what I do is anything that's not available from my streaming services that's in my library, mm-hmm. I have uploaded to Google Play Music.
Same.
So
for me, it's just like it's the Beatles. I have like my whole Beatles collection in Google Play Music. And when I want to listen to the Beatles, that's where I go.
And Zeppelin.
Mm. Yep.
And all my Pink Floyd bootlegs.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's a nice, like I use it as like the stopgap.
Yeah.
Right. So here's my question for you about Apple Music. Are you going to pay for it at the end of September? Are you going to use it as your $10 a month? Are they going to get your $10 bill with a picture of, I don't know, who's on it? Martha Washington?
the Harriet Tubman.
She was a hip lady.
True story. I don't know.
Yeah.
I will continue to use it because some of the radio stuff that they have is great.
Yeah, you like the radio station.
I do, and I like it.
Do you need to pay for that?
No.
We don't know yet?
You don't need to. So the radio stuff, the curated radio stuff where all you do is turn it on, mm-hmm. will always be free.
Okay.
And I will probably always use that. Like, I would say I probably spend, I don't know, at least 30 minutes a day listening to Pete's music. Mm-hmm. Or Beats One, rather, which is a pretty big number. And it's just a useful thing for when I need noise, mm-hmm. right? And I'm like, I don't even want to think about what genre I want to listen to. I just want there to be noise.
Yep.
And Beats One is great for that because it's always noise. Sometimes I like it, sometimes I hate it, but it's always noise. Like, I would say I probably like, I don't know, 30% of the music on Beats One, which is fine. And 50% of it,
How can you leave it on if you only like 30% of it?
It's fine. It's noise. Like, it's honestly, it's noise. I would listen to, you know, there used to be there was an internet radio thing and they had a station called like Music Salad and it was basically just noise.
Oh, is it DIFM?
Maybe.
Or Soma FM?
I think it was Soma FM.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I will probably continue to listen to that. But the thing for me is going to come down to who has the songs, right? And for right now, it's really hard to tell.
You know, that's never...
It's like I have less, let's say, archaic tastes than you do.
Sure. Well, everybody has different tastes, like, right?
Yeah.
And everybody has songs that they're not going to be able to find.
Not archaic. Obscure was the word I was looking for. Like you
archaic.
Also archaic. But
no, most of the music I listen to is brand new.
Yeah. But I don't know. Like I don't hate the interface enough to immediately say no. Mm-hmm. But I also like Spotify. And I think Spotify is in the middle of trying to do some really interesting stuff that if they pull it off is going to be pretty awesome. But I also don't have a lot of faith that they can do it because I think what they're trying to do, which is basically say, hey, it's, you know, 8:15 in the morning. You're probably on your walk from the train to the office. Here's what you usually listen to.
Yeah.
Just press play.
Yeah.
Like if they can do that, that's amazing.
You know,
but I doubt they can do that.
I still have faith in those services, like those ones that use AI sort of, you know, or some, light version of AI.
Sure.
to sort of guess at what you might want. But, I mean, for me, I'm an RDO person. I'm going to stay with RDO. I think the way I'm looking at it is Apple Music is something that will probably suit my needs just fine once RDO dies.
Yeah. And it inevitably will.
No, I hope it never happens. They're great. I love their mobile app. I love their web interface.
It is better.
I always have that on.
Yeah.
And the other thing is I've gotten really into using the play later or listen later function. So if I'm browsing around and I see a record I want to hear, but maybe I'm not in the mood for it right now,
right.
Or maybe I'm listening to something else that's really long right now, I'll just do play later. Because then whenever I open it up, I just scroll all the way to the bottom of the current playlist and I see all these things that I've lined up and I just pick one.
Smart.
So like
Apple Music has that too.
That's the thing. You know, it's the feature that I've found that I like the most of all these services that will that solves that problem of I just want to listen to music and I don't know what.
Yeah.
For me. I'd rather have it automatically play something that I have already identified as something that I want to hear instead of play me something that I may or may not like.
Right.
That I've never heard of.
Right.
If I want to discover, I have my own tools, my own mental tools that I use for music discovery.
Right. Which I think makes us, I'm the same way, which I think makes both you and I not the target user anymore.
Right.
Which I think is really interesting. And I wonder how that's going to affect how I feel about these services because what they're clearly after is the person who has no idea what they don't want to listen to.
Yeah.
And I almost always have at least a rough idea.
Yeah. You know, and you, I think.
Sometimes I want noise, but most of the time I'm always like, I either want like a genre or I'm like, I want music like this song or I need classical or whatever. Like I have an idea.
Yeah. You have touch points that you would go to for each one of those.
And it seems like this new user that all these services are after has no idea. They just want music and they don't know what the hell they want to listen to.
I mean, that's most people.
Yeah, I guess it is.
You know,
I mean, it's the same with like TV, I guess, to some extent.
Like when somebody first showed me Pandora, they're like, well, it's pretty cool. You know, you put in like a band that you like and you hit the button and it plays one song by that band and then it starts playing songs by other bands that sound kind of like that. And I'm like, that's desirable to you?
You're like, no, I just want to keep listening to that band.
Yeah, it's like, how come if I want to hear, you know, like, Jane's Addiction. Mm-hmm. How come, like, I type in Jane's Addiction and then it starts playing Smashing Pumpkins? I hate Smashing Pumpkins. This is ridiculous. But yeah, you know, I think like we've both been at this a very long time, and you know, you know what it feels like, and you know how to do this. You have to sort of intellectually separate yourself from what you personally want with what the company is trying to do, and whether or not they're successful at doing that. Right. So I think, you know, it's looking at that. It's looking at it that way. It's a success.
Yeah,
and it's something that I could see, like, even somebody as, you know, anal about music as me would still be able to draw value from it.
Right.
I've heard similar assessments from other people, you know, like in my circle of friends too.
Well, I just think it's interesting that there doesn't seem to be any service left for people. Like, I think of Flickr, mm-hmm. right? Like, Flickr is still what Flickr has always been. And it is wonderfully
mostly
OCD and meticulous and weird. And they've built tools on top of that. But I think the thing I like about Flickr is that if you want to be nuts about it, you can still be nuts about it.
Yeah.
And it's to their credit. And I think what there isn't anymore, whereas like the opposite of Flickr would be like Google Photos, where it says like, don't do any work, we'll do it all for you, just take pictures. Mm-hmm. Everything else is taken care of. And we'll show you what you want to see when you want to see it and so on and so forth. Whereas in music, everything is trying to be Google Photos, right? Like, there is nothing that is geared towards the meticulous keeper of music and a library, and everybody is about discovery now. Like, this idea that we have 30 million songs is so commoditized and uninteresting at this point that everybody's onto this thing where they're like, okay, well, we're going to help you discover what you want to listen to next. And it's interesting to me that nobody has swung back the other way and said, well, okay, you know what you want to listen to next. We're going to make it absurdly easy for you to get it.
Yeah.
And nobody's doing that.
Nobody's doing that. And you know what? Like, that's actually one of my, I forgot about this until just now, until you said this, but that's one of my biggest complaints about Apple Music. When I do know what I want to listen to, it makes it more difficult than it should for me to find that. For example, right? Like, I want to hear a Bob Dylan song. So I know what album it's on, or I just type in the name of the song I type in Bob Dylan.
Sure.
And it shows me, you know, a picture of Bob Dylan and like a little biographical information that I click on to expand. And then right below that, top albums.
Right.
And then I have to scroll down and keep going to get all albums. Mm-hmm. And then I click on that, and then it shows me the list of all of his albums.
And then you're still two steps away from actually listening to the song you want to listen to.
Yeah. And also, it's like, it should not, you know, if I know what I want to listen to, I know, you know, and I know like the name of the album, I can probably just type in the name of the album and that will come up near the top of the search results. But if I just type in Bob Dylan, it makes it that much more difficult for me to find that album, because it, not only is it hidden behind a menu, but that menu is like the thing that to me is most important is like three down, you know, like top albums. Could you imagine what like the crowdsource thinks?
I know.
You know, out of all the Bob Dylan albums, which ones are the top albums? Certainly not the one that I want to hear.
No.
Right?
Well, and I also think, like, I just searched for Isn't She Lovely, mm-hmm. which is, like, A, absurdly famous song. B, there's probably, I would guess, 99.5% of people who search for Isn't She Lovely mm-hmm. are looking for the song by Stevie Wonder. Mm-hmm. And instead, first it tries to search my library, which mm-hmm. is ridiculous because the whole, whatever, stupid Apple Music. And then the other options you give me are basically autocompletes, one of which isn't with an apostrophe between the N and the T, and one of which isn't without the apostrophe. And then I still have to search for it. The search takes forever. And then it gives me a bunch of different artists, a bunch of different albums, a bunch of different songs, playlists. And it's like, just play the song. Mm-hmm. Like, I should, in all honesty, and Spotify does a pretty good job of this, where it will pull up, like, if I search for Isn't She Lovely in Spotify, it will get, the first thing will be a direct link to play the song.
Yep.
And it's so crazy that Apple doesn't do that as well, because, like you said, like, I'm happy to be as specific in my searching as I want, or as is required, but just take me to the damn song.
And on mobile, I mean, you know, searches are painful because you have to type them, right? And, like, if you typed Stevie Wonder, you wouldn't get, you know, Songs of the Key Life as your first result. You would get like Intervisions and Talking Book and the Best of Musiquarium. You know, those would be your top albums. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to like go digging for Songs of the Key Life. I don't know. Yeah. I'm just guessing. Maybe Songs of the Key Life is one of the top three Stevie Wonder albums, but I can't imagine is, considering it's not as hit loaded as all of his other songs stuff.
You get number ones first and then the definitive collection. Oh, Songs of Key of Life is in there. Okay.
It is?
Yeah.
In top albums?
Uh-huh.
Well, okay, great.
One of the first five, which right. is like, congratulations.
Now search for Prince. Ha ha, just kidding.
Wah, wah. What does come up?
He's out there hanging out with all the windows.
Oh, Prince Royce. Prince Royce is, I'm sure, just cleaning up on the fact that Prince is not in.
Really? What about Prince Lasha?
Yeah, we can listen to the Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian. That could be cool. Prince of Darkness by Ozzy Osbourne.
There's actually a Phish song called Prince Caspian.
Yeah.
It is my least favorite Phish song. Anyway, we've gone over time, but it's good to be back.
I know. It's good to have you back.
Oh, thank you. Also,
you can't leave ever again. You know that, right? You can't leave this room, this literal tiny white room with these soundproofing blankets. You can't leave here.
You're trying to be like Apple Music and box me in, man.
Basically. And you're never going to know where you are. We're going to turn off the lights. You're going to be hopelessly disoriented all the time.
Also, I should mention that we have a new engineer, Gordon. Say hello, Gordon.
What's up?
What's up? Gordon is with us until the end of the year.
I've decided I like Gordon.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
It was touch and go there for a while, but I've decided I like Gordon.
What brought you around? Was it his dry wit or his teen appeal?
Mostly the teen appeal, if I had to be honest. It's the shy good looks. That's what I would say.
Generation Z, baby. All right. So if you want to send us feedback, and you should because we love it.
True.
You should send it to both of us at Gadget Lab. And you can also talk to David. He's still Pierce David.
That's true. For now.
Regardless of his best
Twitter,
efforts.
I will get you.
On Twitter. And I am at Snackfight on Twitter. That's Snackfight with an SN.
Is there a Gadget Lab email address?
I think there was, but it's like so old.
Yeah, don't email that.
It probably goes to like
Twitter's
people
good.
Who no longer
we pay
there.
Attention to Twitter.
Yeah.
Twitter's good.
Yeah, Twitter's good. It's the best way to reach us for sure. Also, you can follow along with all the things we talked about on wired.com/gear, which is where all of our beautiful, wonderful stories live. And we'll be back next week. Will we have a guest next week? Or
let's say yes.
If we don't have a special guest next week, we'll have one the week after.
True.
But we're going to experiment with a three-person
show. It's
going
to be fun.
At some point. We're both looking at the microphone.
Yeah, there's an empty chair, empty microphone. It's going to be awesome.
All right. So until next week.